Hello, everybody. This is the New York Foreign Press Association, and this is our webinar on the state of UNRWA and the media. And it is on the state of the media of UNRWA, because one of the things we've noticed is that many of our colleagues have fallen down in their duty to ask the right questions and to even frame things in the right way. Too many of us have adopted epithets. There's always an epithet machine that goes, and it's very difficult to break the habit because journalists are hard-pressed and lazy, quite apart from any prejudice. For many years, Margaret Thatcher was always introduced as the woman who privatized the loss-making state industries. And I used to write to the New York Times saying, no, she didn't. They were all making shitloads of money. That's why she could sell them so easily. And it's that type of epithet production that we see, Hamas-backed, Iran-backed. That is not a means of adding information. That's a means of slanting the information. And you can put it in if you want. It is possible you can say that they say the Houthis are Hamas-backed. It's a stretch to say that Hamas is Iran-backed because they're somewhat different Sunni and Shia, as any student of the area knows. But in the case of UNRWA, what happened was a perfect storm of years of beleaguering the UN as mismanagement and corrupt, which, when it's investigated, is almost invariably not true or not nearly as bad as said. And the accusations are often made by people far more corrupt. So it slants the information. And what we had here was the amazing coincidence that within almost hours of the ICJ delivering its surprising, I must say I was surprised at how strong it was, verdict on the October 7th events and subsequently, out came this story. And I thought, no, they must have checked it. They must have checked this, but had a sneaking suspicion. And since then, it has been revealed that the dossier was not handed over, that the head of UNRWA was offered the information or told the information, and I wouldn't necessarily say in a panic, but let's say he's been under very hard pressure, immediately thought something must be done and fired all the people against whom the allegations were made. It's now called reverse due process. And I've reported on many incidents like this in the UN where a panicked secretary general or officer has fired people who were subsequently found completely innocent. So I was extremely suspicious. I was also aware, as people here will be, that Israeli ambassadors, many Israeli ambassadors over the years, have attacked UNRWA because they really hate it. It's a pathological thing. And by the way, I have to say, and I think Chris will bear this out, that we have actually found that there are Israeli government administrators who pray with thanks to the Lord for UNRWA, because otherwise Israel will be faced with a huge burden. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza would have been unsustainable without the international money that goes in through UNRWA, because under the Geneva Conventions, Israel is on the tick for it. So that's the sort of background we're talking about and trying to think through the questions that were asked and weren't asked. The big question was there any evidence? I think our panelists will come say, now, very little, not very much, not very substantial. And yet that has stopped the funding for not just the refugees in Gaza, but those in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and the West Bank as well. So this is all on, let's say, unexamined allegations. So I want to come in on this because Chris would be a good person to start, because Chris used to be at the UN as the BBC World Correspondent. He then went to become spokesperson for UNRWA in Gaza, a thankless task. Nice beach, but the rest has its drawbacks. And he was he fought valiantly against many attempts to blacken UNRWA and its name and bring a few facts into the details. We have Ben Armbruster, who wrote a piece for the Quincy Institute, Responsible Statecraft, which perhaps blessed by not years of close attention to this, to the particular subject of the Middle East, like some of the rest of us, he managed to see how the media were covering it. And we have Kristen Salumi, who has been at the Al Jazeera bureau chief at the United Nations and watching for years as Israeli ambassadors have swung from the chandeliers about UNRWA and other matters somewhat intemperately. These are the people, by the way, the former ambassador did call for the Secretary General to be fired. He did not act as promptly as UNRWA did. He hasn't fired himself yet on the strength of an Israeli allegation. So there's a lot to chew here. Mostly, we're trying to angle it to how should the media cover this and what traps should they look at? Which epithets should they be avoiding? Which sources are fairly toxic and insubstantial and disproven so? Not that they're saying things that we dislike, but saying things that they can't prove. So over to you, Chris. Give them hell.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be on this panel. And this is a panel that I feel kind of is in my gut and has actually been there for really a very long time, because almost as soon as I got to UNRWA, I was dealing with this huge onslaught, which was interesting because it was very much part of a, and I'm not buying into Elders of Zion conspiracy theories, but anything I said would immediately be texted to someone on the Appropriations Committee in Washington who had an instant line back to my boss via the UNRWA office in DC or via a representative office, whatever. So I did feel under scrutiny from the media in a way which I think no other UN spokesperson would ever feel. And so that was my first kind of introduction to how this business worked. There was a network which was hanging on my every word and wanting me to fail and put my foot in it at every possible stage, and showed itself very willing always to go the extra mile for misinterpreting me and for really making the most. And the clear political agenda, as is now really, you know, gloves are off now, is the destruction of UNRWA. There's a three-phased approach. One is delegitimizing, so a smear campaign. One is defunding, which we're seeing now. And then thirdly, it's dismantling. And we're kind of between stages two and three right now, though we can talk about whether, you know, reports of UNRWA's death are premature or not. To be very clear and to take one step back away from the journalism, there are sources and institutions and organizations and individuals clearly funded either by Israel or by people close to Israel or rich members of the exilic diaspora community who put money into organizations who were there as part of the sort of echo chamber, this international pro-Israel echo chamber, which is there for journalists to quote. And the more they're quoted and the more it echoes, the greater quasi-authority this misinformation takes on. So to give you an example of some of those groups, UN Watch, which, as far as I'm aware, was established in the days of Kofi Annan, which got accreditation with ECOSOC in the days when Kofi Annan, God bless his soul, was going on a charm offensive towards Israel. And to start with, UN Watch's agenda was very clear. All they ever did was attack people who were remotely critical of Israel. And then when they began to be exposed as a kind of pro-Israel, pro-Zionist, single issue, axe to grind, politically driven organization, they put out various fig leaves and started talking about human rights in Iran and other places, and tried to make it look as if really what they weren't trying to do was to protect Israel. And when all of this stuff came up again on the 7th of October, I started to see UN Watch being quoted as a source. So, for example, the figure of 10% of UNRWA workers are affiliated with Hamas. That, from what I could see, was sourced to UN Watch. Now, the word affiliated is excellently vague. What on earth does that mean? It's hard to prove, it's hard to disprove. And that's, you know, one of the other things about these groups, the stuff they put out was eminently undeniable, in the sense that how can you disprove an untruth? Not only have they in the past made accusations, were they not, after the 7th of October, involved in this misinformation about the UNRWA, the figures for the number of staff who are affiliated with Hamas, but actually they, for example, one of the last things I did in 1919 was deal with an attack by UN Watch and an organization called Impact SE, which purports to be an organization trying to promote good curricula around the region, curricula that embodied UN values, etc. They did a huge attack, which they sent to all of UNRWA's donors, on UNRWA's curriculum. The big problem is that they got the wrong curriculum, and they weren't talking about
UNRWA's curriculum for UNRWA schools, that because UNRWA runs the schools.
Correct. So UNRWA teaches the host authority curriculum wherever it works. So UNRWA is preparing children for public exams in Syria. So in Syria, it teaches the Syrian curriculum. In Jordan, they teach the Jordanian curriculum. In the West Bank, since Oslo, since 1994, UNRWA has taught the Palestinian Authority curriculum, which the education ministry, the Palestinian Education Ministry, uses. On another occasion, Impact SE attacked the PA curriculum. Only trouble is they got confused with the Jordanian and the Egyptian curriculum. So, you know, these are organizations with, as far as I'm concerned, zero credibility. On another occasion, UN Watch attacked UNRWA staff members. And when we started to investigate, more than half of those they were talking about weren't even UNRWA staff members. And those who we did start to look into, many had been, but were separated, and some were being investigated anyway. So they have a long history of putting out complete misinformation. Now, if I was a BBC correspondent for 23 years, I worked at the BBC, including as a correspondent for 23 years, if an organisation had repeatedly got things wrong and was clearly launching and was part of a huge political attack on an organisation I was reporting on, I simply wouldn't use them anymore. And yet, on whatever day it was, the day after, the 27th of January, the day after the ICJ made its provisional, made its demand for provisional orders on Israel and the other state parties of the Genocide Convention, the New York Times basically took its face value stuff that UN Watch had put out. And on the dodgy dossier that Ian, you referred to, dodgy dossier being a reference to the exaggerated security claims that Tony Blair took Britain to war on, based on in Iraq, turned out to be complete nonsense. But this dodgy dossier, when I started to look into it, I've got a copy. If anybody wants a copy of it, just send me an email and I'll send it to them. It was a list of allegations. There was no evidence. And it was never passed on to UNRWA by the Israelis or any of the major donors, the Americans, the Brits, the Canadians, you know, whoever else, who were defunding. In fact, just in this week's Private Eye, which I'm reading now, it's just come through my letterbox, there's a wonderful article about this, and it's very clear that Private Eye contacted the Foreign Office and tried to find out if it actually knew what the evidence was on which it was basing a decision which would see hundreds of thousands of people fall from extreme hunger into starvation, and to see UNRWA services across the Middle East potentially threatened. And it's very clear from the quote in Private Eye from the press person in the Foreign Office that they actually did not have any idea of what was in the dodgy dossier. If you look at what Tony Blinken said, he said something like, we've not been able to independently confirm these allegations, but I think they're credible. So he's saying they're credible, but on the other hand, he's saying we weren't able independently to confirm them. I mean, there is a certain logical disconnect between the two parts of those sentences. The Canadian government has confirmed pretty much on the record that it has not seen any evidence. So I suppose what I'm trying to get at is that even before you get to what the journalists are reporting, you have a whole ecosystem out there, an echo chamber, call it what you will, of groups funded, we think, by Israel, and UN Watch are very opaque when it comes to who funds them, where they get their money from, what are their connections with, you know, Zionist extreme right-wing organizations in Israel. It's very hard to find any of that stuff out. But all I'd say was, even before we get to the question of journalism, which I'd be very happy for other members of this panel to address, you have a major problem, which is that as the unspokesperson, I know from lived experience, there's a whole group, you know, NGO Monitor, UN Watch, David Bedin, if ever you've ever heard of him, he's put out so many mendacious films. He'd go into PA schools around the West Bank. He'd ask children leading questions like, how much do you hate Jews? How many Jews do you want to kill? You know, as experienced journalists, we know we can make 11-year-old children say almost anything if you ask them irresponsible enough questions. David Bedin would then take pictures of Hamas summer camps, etc., and then put it out to the donor community as if these were UNRWA children in UNRWA schools, UNRWA summer camps. I've analysed every single frame that David Bedin put out while I was the UNRWA Commissioner General, and I can tell you it is all utter nonsense. So I suppose in opening this panel, what I want to say is we can look at what journalists do. And as I say, I think the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal were very much doing the bidding of the far right in Israel, who have a fascist agenda to destroy UNRWA, because they think that if you destroy UNRWA, you destroy the refugees and their right of return, which of course is a bit like saying that if you get rid of Oxfam, you get rid of hungry and poor people. It's based on a complete fiction. These refugees are individuals who have both individual and collective rights, including rights to development, education, health, the right to self-determination. And it might be a fascist dream that you can just get rid of them by waving UNRWA away. But unfortunately, they are individuals, all of whom have a dignity and a destiny which must be respected. And no amount of news manipulation and news management will ever change that fundamental fact about the humanity of the 5.9 million individuals who UNRWA serves. And at that point, I think I should end. Thank you, Ian.
As I understand it, the Journal and the New York Times were actually given the dossier before UNRWA and the governments. And
UNRWA's never been given it. Wait. UNRWA's
koshered it. That's what I mean. They koshered this dossier and have since walked it back. They prepared podcasts and packages about it. And then somebody more sober in there looked at it and said, whoops, I see a few holes in this. So they announced the grand premiere of the information has not yet appeared. But now we should go over to Ben. Ben, I don't think I'm mischaracterizing you, but you haven't been rolling in the mud on this issue the same way the rest of us have. So, you know, you, in a sense, you bring a fresh eye from the outside. How did you get into it and see what was, because your article was very perceptive in Responsible Statecraft. You got right to the nub of it quickly.
Yeah, so I certainly haven't been as far in the mud on this issue as you have, but I have dipped my toes in over the years. So I know a little bit about how the Israel-Palestine issue is covered in an American media context, and of course it's not good ever. How I got into this particular issue was, you know, I was following the news sort of casually, just like anyone else would who is interested in the war in Gaza right now, and, you know, saw how the news from UNRWA was being reported, and just sort of accepted it at face value and sort of passing. And then a few days later, I was watching a report from Channel 4 in the UK, and it was completely different. They actually had an entire segment, which I believe, Chris, you participated in, that focused on the fact that there was no evidence in this dossier. And I then thought, well, where are these U.S. outlets why are they reporting this news as if it is true? So what I ended up doing is I went back and I looked at all of the major US news outlets, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, CNN, and also the CBS, NBC, and ABC News evening programs. And, you know, most of them who noted that they had seen the dossier in their reporting did not note that there was no evidence. And I mean, I was shocked at how often this happened, because as a journalist, you know, we are taught to scrutinize claims. And when we are handed purported evidence, we are taught to examine and determine whether or not, you know, it's true. And in this case, it did not happen. I mean, it barely happened at all. And when it did, it was very, very much in passing. So for example, you know, I noted in the piece that, you know, CBS Evening News, in their report on this news, on the 2 minute report, you know, 3 seconds was devoted to the fact that it had no, you know, it was, it, it, the dossier contained no evidence of the Israeli claims. So, I mean, I sort of gave them the benefit of the doubt and saying that that was, you know, a good piece of journalism. But in the end of the day, you know, most of these American news outlets who did note that there was no evidence, you know, didn't do so in the much more forceful way that some other news outlets have done. And, you know, and I think that that, you know, to bring this sort of zoom out a little bit and present some of the context here, is that this is how the Israel issue is generally covered in the US by the mainstream media. I mean, there is, you know, this goes back decades, as we all know, but, you know, the Israeli narrative is generally given preference in the mainstream media, in Washington, in Congress, in US politics in general. And I think that that seeps into the coverage of these issues. And, you know, to echo something, what Chris said, you know, there is also an organized, there's an organized effort to push back on journalists who are critical of Israel, even in, you know, whether it's true, you know, even if it's true, even if what journalists are reporting about Israel is true, but it is critical, they will experience, you know, criticism and pain from their editors, from their donors, or whomever it is that they are, you know, beholden to. There are folks on the far right in the US, in Washington, who will go after you. So it's not just, you know, the fact that the Israeli narrative is accepted. It's also the fact that there are efforts to prevent, any other course of action, really.
Have you had any blowback from your piece yet?
No. And I think that there is a reason for that, is because I think those who are part of these efforts to undermine criticism of Israel know that my bosses won't listen to them. This is kind of a long story, but, you know, I was a journalist at Think Progress, which is a left progressive news outlet that was housed in a Washington think tank. It no longer exists. But we were writing back in, you know, about 10 years ago or so, we were writing pieces critical of Israel. We were writing articles that were questioning whether or not Iran had nuclear weapons, and promoting diplomacy with Iran. And these people went to our bosses and said, hey, you know, you better cut this out, or, you know, we're gonna, you know, tell X person to stop funding you. you know, will come down on you pretty hard. And the bosses at the Center for American Progress basically told us to stop writing about it. So you know, that's a microcosm of how it works really in this town. Being critical of Israel is could be detrimental to your career.
Well, in this case, we're not even asking people to be critical. It's not like Sky News, which I see now has a boilerplate that every time somebody makes a criticism about IDF behavior, they have to recite a paragraph saying that the IDF, of course, denies that they ever knowingly target innocent civilians and always take, I mean, it's a whole paragraph that they slip in on every occasion. And sometimes even the speaker challenges them on that this is coming. But you've had, the kickback that you got there was fine in a sense because they resisted it. In most cases, they don't, do they? And you have this epithet machine working that always, the corrupt, mismanaged UNRWA. By the way, I think we should put out that I did a piece for Al Jazeera, which exposed corruption and mismanagement in UNRWA Gaza, not because of its political stance, but because of a few individuals. I think it's part of the process. It's why the Fourth Estate is needed to keep keep organizations like this on track. But UNRWA has, I've been there. You've seen it. All across, we have Trudeau, who many of us expected better things from. We have the British government. We have the French government. We have the German government, all jumping on the bandwagon to roll over UNRWA. This is disastrous consequences. Why aren't those governments being roasted over the fire? You are cutting off supplies in defiance of the ICJ order, which says, in fact, that they must facilitate the feeding and nurture of the refugees. They're defying it by cutting off on the basis of unsubstantiated slander and rumor. That's a very serious charge. Nothing to do with UNRWA. That's a charge against those governments, that they are recklessly unethical and irresponsible. And, you know, how can we get that across to people?
Is that a question for? Oh. I'll let Kristen take that one.
I just wanted to point out that the dossier and the reporting on it in the Wall Street Journal, it turns out that the journalist who did that story used to work for the IDF herself. That came out afterwards as well. And there is this pattern that we've seen of Israel making accusations, very strong accusations that capture the attention of the media, and then later walking it back. I think of Al Jazeera's journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed in the West Bank. And initially, the claims were that she was caught in crossfire, even though people on the scene and the journalists on the scene there said that that wasn't the case. They didn't see how that could be possible. That was overlooked. And in the rush to do this story, and in the rush to do any story, often US media run with these claims before fully vetting them. And then later, when Israel's forced to walk it back, the headline has faded, the interest in the story has faded. And so the damage is already done. And in the case of the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, multiple independent sources crowdsourced video from the day. They looked at who was in the area, who was fighting, found out it couldn't have been crossfire, that the only one that had a direct line of fire towards her was the IDF, who was conducting operations there. And so slowly the accusations were rolled back, but it was too late. For many people, they'd only heard the initial report. And I think also in this case, that's the same. we say that the United States and the United Kingdom haven't actually seen the dossier. The UN hasn't actually seen the dossier. The Secretary General's spokesperson, the Secretary General himself, said that the allegations were credible enough that they felt they had to act quickly. And clearly, they're concerned about being able to do their job, given the history of UNRWA being attacked by Israel and being undermined by Israel. They wanted to get ahead of it and make sure that there was nothing that was going to stand in the way of their job getting aid in, given the difficult situation that they're under right now. But they have said that they have not seen the full report from Israel yet. I mean, the Secretary General hasn't spoken to Netanyahu. He hasn't had conversations with them. So I think for journalists, we have to remember this when accusations are made and make sure that we're asking questions to people other than Israeli authorities when these accusations are made.
Do you think it would be useful if the Secretary General did speak to Netanyahu and to Trudeau and to Cameron and to all of the others and say publicly, you are starving millions of people following a will-o'-the-wisp? Have you no shame, as one of his predecessors said in Senate? I mean, the famous naming and shaming is certainly due for here, but why doesn't he? Because he's scared of the pressure.
It's clear when you attend their briefings that he is trying to walk this fine line. His rhetoric has gotten stronger as the conflict has gone on. He still will not directly say Israel is violating international humanitarian law. He'll say bombing civilians in war is a violation of international law. He's very careful about how he is quoted. But if you listen to him carefully, he's saying it. He's saying it in a circular way. So the sound bites for those of us in television or the quotes are have to be put in context to appreciate his criticism. And for many, it's not strong enough. Many, as you say, would like to see him publicly and privately be more direct in his criticism.
A bit more distance than the rest of us from the United Nations, perhaps. What's your take? Can you see ways that the United Nations could actually spring to the defense of UNRWA and
it's
serious finger at the media?
It's possible, and it certainly couldn't hurt. I do wonder, though, whether that would have any serious effect on the sort of the train that's already left the station in Washington, because, you know, as some of you noted already, there has been a decades long effort to get rid of UNRWA. And, you know, the Israeli, you know, the you know, the allies in Washington of the Israeli government have been helping them do this for a long time, particularly in Congress. And, you know, I think the Israeli government is very smart, and they know that allegations like this would fly through the U.S. media unchallenged. And after these reports were surfaced, you know, the momentum built so quickly. And that's because of the context of where we came from with UNRWA, in that there have been many in this town who have wanted to get rid of it, to defund it, and this was their opportunity. You know, it's already happening in Congress right now. The bill that just passed the Senate to give funding to Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel diverted aid to the Palestinians away from UNRWA. And there is currently a bill being considered in the House to permanently defund UNRWA. So, you know, that train has already left the station. So I don't necessarily think that, you know, sharp criticism from UN figures would do too much. It could get coverage, but I don't really know, you know, how much, you know, that would actually do. I mean, the strange thing is that, you know, the Biden administration cut, you know, paused their funding so quickly. And I noted this in my piece that National Security Council spokesman John Kirby, who has, you know, not been a stellar, has pretty, you know, pretty bad record on this, you know, so far since October 7th in terms of, you know, his support for the Israeli government and all that. But he, you know, he said point blank on television that, you know, we shouldn't punish UNRWA because of the actions of a few employees. So there's a little bit of mixed messaging coming out of the Biden administration. We'll see what happens there. But, you know, momentum in Washington is currently strong against UNRWA right now.
Ian, if I may also just jump in, and hearing what Kristen said also, one of the problems is that if you have a man like Mark Regev, who is the official, you know, the highest level spokesperson in the Israeli government, who is prepared to lie, what is a journalist who's producing news reports, you know, by the hour supposed to do? So a typical example is on the BBC website, I think I saw it today, there's a story about how allegedly an UNRWA teacher kept an Israeli hostage in her attic or their attic. And UNRWA got to the root of this report, and it's an Israeli Channel 13 diplomat, journalist called Almog Boker. And UNRWA contacted him and said, either produce your evidence or cease and desist. You know, either show us what it is, or would you please stop putting this stuff out? And the guy's been completely exposed. It is pure hearsay. And yet Mark Regev has again repeated this stuff and put that story on the BBC. As far as I can tell, it is a complete nonsense. It's no evidence, no empirical basis for it whatsoever. And yet it gets repeated. So what is a journalist supposed to do? I mean, should there be a boilerplate, you know, Mark Regev, who's been known to have lied to journalists in the past? Because all the way through the 2014.
Yes, there should be.
Journalists used to phone me whenever they hit seven of UNRWA schools in 2014. And every time it happened, a journalist would phone up and say, Mark Regev told us that there were militants in your compounds firing rockets into Israel. And at the end of the war in 2014, there was a board of inquiry, a BOI, and it found that in none of those cases were there any militants in our schools. In the fog of war, I mean, we couldn't, because there was a war going on, necessarily get people into these schools to investigate, to do interviews, to talk to the staff. You know, very reliable, you know, old-fashioned kind of teachers who are very much educationists, who are on the side of having neutral, you know, schools, etc. And none of them could provide any evidence of even seeing militants, let alone militants. So, you know, that's problem number one. What happens if you've got an Israeli spokesperson who is prepared to lie? And the other thing is, lying is a deliberate part of subverting the news agenda, right? So it sort of, in a way, it doesn't matter if Mark Regev is lying or not. The whole point of it is to get people like you and me and all the people on this panel and all the other journalists who are listening in to write about, is it true? Are there terrorists in UNRWA? Is UNRWA anti-Semitic? Instead of covering the genocide, instead of covering the humanitarian catastrophe, these apocalyptic scenes in Rafah today, you know, none of that, it is being talked about, thank God, because people like, you know, I was on the BBC this morning ranting and raving about it. But the fact is that part of the lies is precisely to manipulate the news agenda. It doesn't matter if the lie gets found out in 2 months' time, as with the case of Shireen, you know, because it's all over by then. You know, the news agenda's been subverted. And that, I'm afraid, is what's happened, that, you know, this all came out after the ICJ provisional measures ruling, as you said. And the debate since then has really been about, is UNRWA anti-Semitic? You know, are its staff terrorists? Are they colluding with Hamas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So in a way, we shouldn't be shocked to discover that Israeli spokespeople are lying, because that's part of the tactic. It's precisely to lie and have a debate about whether they're lying or not.
I'm quite shocked at the idea, the gullibility of journalists to accept that there's an attic in Gaza. They all had flat roofs when I was there. Show me an attic. It's the one with the Christmas tree on. I mean, it's palpably stupid to talk about an attic on a house in a...
Yeah. But, you know, at a time of a war like this, if Mark Regev puts out a press release, journalists are going to report it. I mean, I'd like to ask Chris, I mean, what else do you do? You know, you can... I guess you could ignore it. It happens every day. But, you know, in a sense, that is the most senior spokesperson on the side of one of the belligerent parties. You know, what are you supposed to do?
You report it and debunk it and point out how many times. You don't give it full credence, which is what has been happening. The media will say something, Israeli an IDF spokesman, or even one of these NGOs that Ben mentioned.
Yeah, but Ian, I mean, another example, if I can give one, but both UN Watch and Impact SE, two organizations that have put out palpable lies about UNRWA in the past, they were testifying in Congress when there was the hearing about UNRWA funding and the UNRWA staff and all that stuff. They were in Congress. Well, I mean, what's a journalist supposed to do? Just sort of, you know, report it. And I mean, once one of the belligerent parties is so ingrained into the structure of governance and government, you know, it's really difficult for journalists. And I speak as an ex-journalist, but I mean, it's really, really difficult to keep, you know, they come back and back and back. It's sort of, you know, it's exhausting. And then what I used to end up doing in UNRWA is, instead of doing my job, which was putting out stuff about UNRWA, you know, in the end, 70 or 80% of what I was doing was dealing with donors wanting press reports rebutted. You know, but and again, that's what it's all about. It's about stopping UNRWA doing its real job and subverting even UNRWA's humanitarian agenda. And, you know, they're very good at it, frankly.
I think also,
go on.
A lot of context is missing from a lot of the stories as well, in terms of knowledge of what UNRWA even does. I don't know if you would agree, Chris, but
totally.
For example, the accusation that not only are these 12 UNRWA employees, not only were they aiding the attacks of October 7th, but that there's some 1,200 employees who have, quote, ties to Hamas. You know, but do the articles that say that point out that Hamas is the largest employer in Gaza, followed by UNRWA? So, you know, having contacts or having connections, having ties to Hamas, does that mean that someone in their family works for the government? And to play devil's advocate, can you work for Hamas in a way that is not political? In other words, you know, I assume Hamas employs garbage collectors or municipal type employees that aren't necessarily political, but people who are looking for a job.
Yeah, I mean, to be very clear about this, a very good point you make, actually. But to be clear, under the late lamented Kofi Annan, who was the Secretary General in 2006, when Hamas won the election in Palestine, overwhelmingly in what the Carter Center described as the freest and fairest election ever held in the Middle East, which, by the way, I assume includes Israeli elections. So, you know, Hamas were a political party that won the biggest election victory in the fairest and freest election ever held in the Middle East, right? So, I mean, there's that point that, you know, Israel has characterized Hamas as a sort of ISIS-style terrorist organization, but they are a political movement, and they are a social movement, and they are a charitable movement, and they did win an election overwhelmingly in 2006. And by the way, the reason there's never been another election in Palestine is because everyone knows that Hamas would increase its share of the vote. So there's that little problem that's never, ever part of the contextualizing of this story. But the other thing is that Hamas, Kofi Annan's contact policy was, it went out to all of us in the UN at the time, was contact with Hamas up to and including ministerial level is entirely approved for the implementation of humanitarian mandates, whereas political contacts were completely banned. They were forbidden. In other words, UNRWA, when it's delivering, say, fuel to a hospital, or say it's delivering pharmaceuticals to a hospital, it has to phone up the Ministry of Health, brackets Hamas, and say, we will be delivering 2 truckloads of vaccines to Al-Shifa Hospital. We then probably, the logistics guys, have to phone up the people at the cold storage and say, do you mind making sure that the cold storage room is on? And then can you tell the guy at the gate that we're coming, and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, you have a working level relationship with the de facto authorities, just as the UN has in any other humanitarian field it works in on the planet. There is nothing illegal or disgraceful or to be ashamed of or shameful or anything. That is what a working relationship with the de facto authorities in any humanitarian operation is about. it's entirely legal. But in the eyes of the media, it's this affiliation word, right? You can muddy the water and make it seem much more sinister if you say that there are affiliations. But you know, these are entirely proper and legitimate humanitarian working relationships.
The head of the World Food Programme is McCain's widow. So she is Trump related at the head of the World Food Programme. Should we stop talking to them because she's MAGA implicated?
Yeah. I'd love to know more, by the way, about this Wall Street Journal correspondent who used to work for the IDF. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Could I just, before you answer that question, I also want to note that one of the New York Times reporters who has been covering this issue also is a former IDF soldier and was on the byline of the original New York Times story that broke the news. So his name is Ronan Bergman. Sorry, Kristen.
No, that's fine. Actually,
it comes to the issue of the sort of chain of truth coming in there. I am getting so old now. I remember when nobody could talk to Fatah and the PLO.
Pre-Oslo.
Because they're beyond the pale. I remember, in fact, I know the daughter of the PLO ambassador who invited Andrew Young, the mayor of Atlanta and cabinet minister from, who was it? It was Carter's cabinet. For coffee to talk to the PLO ambassador. Andrew Young was fired peremptorily for talking to the PLO, who then Clinton and the others spent all that time at Oslo with. So this idea of preemptively making people, you know, political lepers, it's very effective. Hamas, not necessarily nice people. GOP and McCain, not necessarily nice people. But we have to deal with them in the real world. So you can't say mustn't talk under any circumstances. But that's what we've managed to get away with. We've managed to coat people with political leprosy if it's inconvenient for their voice to be heard. Ben, you look like you were sort of fulminating on something there.
Nope. I was actually curious, too, about the Wall Street Journal reporter. I did not know that the he or she had ties to the IDF.
She'd been seconded, as far as I know. She was actually moved directly from the IDF's information department to the Wall Street Journal and given leave, a furlough for it. So, I mean, it is pretty shameless. Can you imagine if the Palestinian Authority spokesman was deputed to the Times or the Guardian or to to the New York Times to assist in their news coverage of the area?
Right.
I don't have a lot of details. It wasn't my reporting that uncovered it, but it's out there that she had formerly worked for the IDF.
Okay.
I was also going to say that I think a lot of the power of what Israel has been saying for U.S. media is by relating it to terrorism and using that. I mean, the statement that Hamas still has in its charter the destruction of Israel and then launching this attack, if taken without the context of the history of occupation, pulls at the emotions of most Americans who remember that attack and don't question the context for what's happened. Of course, in journalism school, we're taught that one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. And so we are supposed to avoid using words like that. But since 9/11, those connections have been, and I think a lot of journalists would also see some of the parallels to after 9/11 and the way these wars were waged, as you, Chris, have talked about your reporting after 9/11 and some of the challenges you faced in questioning the weapons of mass destruction and all of that. Your accused of being unpatriotic if you raise those issues, even though that's the job of a journalist.
So I think you raised an interesting point about how the story tugs at people's heartstrings. And the story of UN employees participating in the Hamas attack on October 7th is a step above UN employees being affiliated with Hamas. And I think that that probably played a role in the breathless and unquestioning and uncritical coverage here in the US. I do have a question for all of you, though. I wonder, I think what also played a role in this and giving it some credence is the fact that UNRWA fired these employees so quickly. And I think from an American journalist perspective, you know, I think one might think, oh, well, if they themselves think that this is true, then there's a high possibility that it is true. I wonder if UNRWA had not acted so quickly, where this story would have gone, because it had, as far as I know, the Israelis delivered this information sort of in early January, and it did not come out until late January. So do you guys think that if UNRWA had not fired these employees, it would be a story as it is today?
I actually made that point on the day. I felt, I wasn't sure, but I said, I'm sure there's no evidence, and this is an extremely foolish mistake. In a panic to prove he's cleaning house, he's going to fire these people, and that's going to be taken as validating the accusations. And several governments, I think Canadian government yesterday, actually made that point. Several governments have said that, well, he fired them, so, you know, there must be fire behind this smoke. So it was a very ill-considered move. I notice he's walked it back now. He's now describing it, the head of UNRWA is now describing it as a reverse due process, which I'm afraid is going to go down in history as just a meaningless swallowing of your own words in public.
I think, if I can just say, I mean, I think Philippe Lazzarini hoped that he would head off a donor revolt. I mean, we can, you know, clearly that didn't happen. but I think, just to try and understand in his mind, he thought that if he could implement what UNRWA holds up to the donors as its zero tolerance policy, in order to implement this neutrality frameworks, etc., that the donors would cut him some slack. And that obviously didn't happen. But the thing to say, Ian, I mean, I was in UNRWA for, you know, 13 years plus. And what used to happen is that when accusations like this came up, the donors usually heard about it either in the Israeli media or the local media in their countries, the national medias in their countries that had their own feed from the sort of various kind of Israeli news outlets. And what would happen is they would come to UNRWA privately and they'd say, look, you know, this horrible thing has come up in the press, or our minister's asking us to find out about this, blah, blah, blah. Can we please examine it? Can we please dig into it? Will you get back to us soon and tell us what it is? Let's resolve it and move on. And that is this is the process that had been going on for decades, right? So my question is, whatever you think of Philippe Lazzarini's decision, why didn't the donors do what they had always done, come to UNRWA and say, we've got a problem. In the past, we've worked productively with you to iron out these problems, to see what's behind all this, and we've moved on. Why didn't the donors do that this time? I hear what Ben says, that this is a quantum leap above, you know, UNRWA staff sympathizing with Hamas or being even members of Hamas, blah, blah, blah. But why is it that the donors this time, as a group, I mean, had it been one donor, you know, whatever, that might be understandable. But in the end, it was like within, I think, about 24 to 48 hours, 16 donors had all jumped ship. What is it that explains what felt like a very coordinated campaign and a direct turning away from the usual process, which is to come to UNRWA and say, there is a problem, will you please investigate and come back to us swiftly with an explanation? I think the question needs to be asked of the donors as much as it needs to be asked of Philippe Lazzarini.
And I can only assume that the UN was trying to nip US criticism in the bud.
Yeah.
Let's remember the United States, for all of its support of Israel, is the largest donor to UNRWA.
Yeah.
And they were struggling to get agreements, to get more aid in. And with that being their ultimate goal, getting as much aid in and saving as many lives as possible, they were going to do what they thought necessary to.
Yeah. But Chris, it wasn't helped by the fact, sorry to interrupt you if I may, just to say that I don't think we were helped by the fact that Antonio Guterres so readily bought into the guilty narrative. So his statement was, I was shocked, I was horrified. I mean, you're only shocked and horrified if it's true, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, well, it sort of suggested that he believed it. So
Lazzarini told him it was true. So I mean, it's almost.
No, I don't know. I don't think Lazzarini, no, Ian, I've got to correct you there. I don't think Philippe Lazzarini did say to the Secretary General, this is true, because he hadn't been passed over any evidence, right? So he couldn't get no basis.
He'd fire them, right, and like Ben said, that means
right,
that's...
But he would not, I mean, for whatever reason he fired them for, it was not because he discovered the truth or the evidence. Let's be clear about that. He didn't. He didn't have it. And UNRWA maintains to this day, it was never given the dodgy dossier.
My Can I give it with an old war story? Because everyone seemed to have forgotten it at the UN. 30 years ago, Madeleine Albright went into Boutros Ghali and said there was waste and mismanagement and corruption in the UN procurement department. She went to Boutros Ghali, who promptly fired a dozen senior UN staff who've been there for senior in the sense, some of them have been there since 1945. And he fired them peremptorily. The famous Skylink affair. It turns out that the people who made the accusations was Air America, the CIA airline that wanted the contracts for the UN airlift along the border with Iraq. So in the end, they had to pay everybody huge compensation for firing them unfairly. Admired the whole thing. They validated the accusations against the UN. And by the way, I made an undying enemy of Madeleine Albright for for pointing this out, which I'm not at all ashamed of. But this that's the penalties. It's people did not want to stand up. I mean, you have we had the UN ambassador for the world's biggest country. You had the Secretary General all saying these were guilty. These poor guys were on the verge of suicide until I came knocking on the door and trying to find out their story. Because there's a personal toll here. I mean, God knows. I mean, all of those 10 UNRWA staff have probably got contracts out on their heads. Hope they don't come out in the open. There's always something between them and a drone. But I think we're coming towards the end now. It's been an interesting and productive discussion, which we should have more of, on sources and attribution of sources and evaluation of sources. Because I still think... what was the name of was he the BBC correspondent, ace interviewer, who said he always asked when he goes in front of a statesman or a politician, why is this lying liar lying to me? It was a very good starting point for an
interview. It's actually Jeremy Paxman who famously said whenever he interviews a politician, he imagines the word lying bastard written across their forehead.
That's a good one. It's a bit extreme, but it's a good journalistic precept we should remember. Look, thank you, everybody. Now we've finished with this. Happy Valentine's Day. I'll go and celebrate the anniversary of my meeting with with Bill Clinton so many years ago. And we can go out into the snow. Thank you very much indeed. And this is a serious matter which we should return to. And it's also a successful experiment since we pulled this together in 24 hours. And thank you very much, Ben Armbruster, for being dragooned into this. I hope they're not waiting for you outside. Look up at the sky before you go out.
Sure, there's a few emails.
Okay. Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you. Goodbye. So much.
Foreign Press Association, New York. Bye.